Hello, everybody. You have tuned into From the Hip Radio with Joe Dockery, a two-hour weekly podcast where you will hear great music, thoughtful commentary, and compelling interviews, along with features addressing a wide variety of subjects. From the Hip Radio will not only entertain, but Joe will encourage us all to appreciate the immense beauty that our life's journey together has to offer.
Thanks, Mary Lynn. Today's podcast may be a little shorter than normal. Please forgive me, but it won't disappoint, I assure you. I have a great interview with a Shakespearean scholar, actor, and director, a tribute to my mom and Muhammad Ali, and a shout out to my niece. Lots of great music as usual. So thanks for tuning in, and remember, you can contact me at fromthehipradio@gmail.com with any comments or suggestions. I really appreciate it. So I did something last night that has never happened to me in my life. I fell out of bed. Seriously, I literally fell out of bed. You see, I sleep on my side with a pillow between my legs, which is the best way to sleep as far as your spine is concerned. And I was lying at the edge of the mattress. I remember I was dreaming. In the dream, I had to move to get out of someone's way. I can't remember the circumstance exactly, but I do remember that it wasn't dire. It wasn't a situation where I felt I had to move quickly. It was just a casual step-out-of-the-way situation. Then I hear this loud, crashing thud, and the room shakes like someone had just fallen out of bed. And in that instant later, I realized, oh my God, it's me. I find myself there on all fours with my knees and my toes all aching. My legs and feet must have been flexed when I fell. We got this thick pillow top mattress, and it's really high up off the floor, so I experienced this free fall, still sleeping, from the bed down to the floor. I was lucky I didn't hit my head on the corner of the nightstand. After I shook the cobwebs from my brain, I got up and I got back into bed. I nuzzled into the middle, and then Mary Lynn gets this hot flash, and she says, "Hey, Joe, you're just going to have to move over." "You mean over near the edge of the cliff?" I wasn't so sure I wanted to do that. I think we're going to have to get one of those bed rails like I had when I slept in the top bunk as a kid. I couldn't find any falling out of bed songs, but this gives me a good excuse to bring out Patsy Cline.
I fall to pieces.
Love me too.
The way you used to do.
Used to do.
But
Patsy Cline and I Fall to Pieces. It wasn't long after I started listening to Emmylou Harris that Linda Ronstadt came on my radar. She covered I Fall to Pieces, along with a few other songs made famous by Patsy Cline. Those two women were certainly setting me up for my appreciation for country music, but it would be another year, 1976 in fact, before I made the deep dive into classic country. But that story is for another time. Now, I'm sure you noticed that Patsy Cline was not alone on that recording of I Fall to Pieces. She had the Jordanaires singing those classic backup vocals. You may know them from the many recordings they did with Elvis Presley and how instrumental they were in helping Elvis create his sound. But they also recorded on nearly every Patsy Cline record that she made before her untimely death in a plane crash at 30 years old. The Jordanaires just became more and more popular over the years, singing not only with Elvis, but also on a Ringo Starr album and with Dolly Parton. And they didn't limit themselves strictly to country music. Here are the Jordanaires singing backup for one of my favorite retro rock groups, the Blasters.
Hey girl, don't you keep me hanging on. Don't you keep me hanging on. Come back where you belong. Girl, don't you stick along. Hey girl, don't you stick along. Don't you keep me hanging on. I hope you're thinking my heart's breaking. Girl, don't you stick along. See by the river where I carved your name, the birds would sing every day.
Those are the Blasters, joined by the Jordanaires on backup vocals with Hey Girl. You know, growing up Catholic and being educated in that system for 14 years, I came across all aspects of the church. What seemed to have the most prominent effect on me was the church's involvement in social justice issues. My parents did instill in all of us a general concern for others. So when I independently read about Daniel Berrigan, a Jesuit priest who protested the Vietnam War, it just seemed so natural to me, as did the liberation theology movement of Jesuit priests in Latin America. Of course the church would be involved in anti-war expression and the wanton killing that comes with the fog of war. And of course the church would be concerned about the poor and oppressed fellow Catholics in Latin America. But what I didn't understand was why these issues did not seem that important to the Catholic clergy that I was exposed to. Well, other than two very influential nuns that I had as teachers. And more on that later, but now back to my mom. Recently, my sisters Mary and Marcy sent me an essay my mother had written at a pivotal point in her life that has given me some clarity in why my views point in that direction. Here's a story that I call Mom, Muhammad Ali, and a Peek Toward Enlightenment. We watched the movie One Night in Miami recently, a fictional account of a real-life social gathering between Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, NFL great Jim Brown, and legendary singer Sam Cooke. Ali had just beaten Sonny Liston to claim the heavyweight boxing title at the age of 22, and Malcolm X invited the men to his hotel room for a quiet celebration after that bout. While the conversation is fictional, the riveting dialogue addresses social and personal issues that would certainly have been discussed among the four principals at some point in their friendship. I highly recommend this movie. Jim Brown would leave the NFL 4 years later in 1966, in the prime of his career, after a dispute with his team's owner to pursue what became a successful career in acting. Cook, however, would be killed and Malcolm X would be assassinated both within a year of that historic gathering in Miami. In 1967, and while still undefeated, Ali refused to be inducted into the armed service. His claim of being a conscientious objector was rejected, and he was convicted of evading the draft and sentenced to 5 years in prison, along with a $10,000 fine, the maximum penalty. His conviction would eventually be overturned, but not before Ali would lose 4 years of boxing in the prime of his athletic career. Most of the nation at that time was speaking against Ali. Try to imagine how tough it must have been to be black, a member of the Nation of Islam, and anti-war in the 60s here in America. Even many in the black community, including Jackie Robinson and boxing great Joe Louis, denounced Ali. John Carlos, the famed Olympic sprinter who protested at the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City, he said, "If there was an Olympic sport for the number of death threats received, Muhammad Ali and Martin Luther King would be fighting for the gold." During his exile, Ali still had to pay bills and take care of his family, so he went on a college campus speaking tour. He made very little money at these speaking engagements, and he faced the controversy wherever he spoke. At first, he was not a very good speaker. He stayed pretty much to the Nation of Islam playbook of religious dogma. But after being forced to debate with college students, Ali began to find his own voice. While he was not necessarily enamored with the idea of nonviolence, as a matter of fact, once saying he didn't believe in turning the other cheek, he found an ally in Martin Luther King. King quoted, "He is giving up his fame. He's giving up millions of dollars in order to stand for what his conscience tells him is right. No matter what you think of his religion, you have to admire his courage." Ali also agreed with King about the Vietnam War and the government discriminating against the poor, especially the black poor. And looking back with 21st century eyes, I don't think it's very hard to not side with Ali when he stated, "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights?" Or when he said on TV, "My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They didn't rob me of my nationality. They never raped and killed my mother and father. Why would I want to shoot them? For what? How can I shoot them, poor people? Just take me to jail." In 1969, while most of the nation had a negative opinion of Ali, my mother admired him. We would all laugh when she would paraphrase Ali, exclaiming, "I never said I was the smartest, just the greatest." Looking back now, I'm sure his social stance was something my mother must have sympathized with. As a 13-year-old boy, however, much of it was lost on me. I had no idea what Jim Crow meant at that time. But in April of that year, I knew she was serious about her fondness for Ali when we found out that he would be speaking at St. Ambrose College in my hometown, one of the stops on his speaking tour, and she asked me if I'd join her to go see him. I was a huge sports fan and eager to see Ali, but I'm not going to lie, I did have some apprehension. Only the year before, Martin Luther King had been assassinated in April. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June. And on top of that was the campus protests associated with the anti-war movement. That summer, there was tremendous unrest in cities all across the country, and the threat certainly lingered in our Quad City area of nearly 350,000 people. I knew there would be a black Muslim presence at that lecture, and my ignorance would equate the Nation of Islam with the Black Panthers. How naive. But I looked forward to sharing the opportunity with my mother. Her sympathy for those less fortunate was instilled in her, I believe, by her father, my grandfather, Dr. John Martin, who helped immigrants gain U.S. citizenship in and around Davenport. After graduating from high school and working for a few years prior to marrying my father, my mom became a bit aimless. She confided in a local priest who was a friend of our family and gave her books to read, including philosophy material. She would attend lectures at St. Ambrose College, and one evening heard a talk by Baroness Catherine Duhuake Doherty. Duhuake Doherty was a Catholic social worker from Russia who started a hospitality house for blacks in Harlem. My mom was so moved how she outlined the injustices facing the black population that she would soon write to her and received an invitation to visit. So on the train she went, bound for New York City by herself. This was the late 30s, and World War II had not involved the U.S. at that time. While in New York, her eyes were opened as she not only visited the hospitality house in Harlem, but also Dorothy Day's The Catholic Worker Movement location in the Bowery. Social justice from then on was a concern for my mom, and certainly on her mind that night she and I attended Ali's lecture. I don't remember much about the specifics of Ali's speech, but I do remember him saying how he didn't think the black and white races would ever be able to get along and that they should remain separate. Looking back, he hadn't quite evolved in the way Malcolm X had, influenced by his pilgrimage to Mecca where he witnessed Muslims of all colors worshiping peacefully together. Or maybe Ali had evolved, and he saw that Malcolm X's matured position on tolerance may have been exactly what have gotten him killed. I don't know. As the evening ended, Ali came off that stage, and he was being led right towards us on his way to the exit. My mom quickly ripped a corner from an envelope she had in her purse. She gave me a pen and said, "Hey, see if you can get an autograph." I remember the crowd rushing toward him, and I got swept into the surge and found myself right in front of his path. I held out the paper and pen as he approached. He grabbed it, signed his name, handed it back to me, and was quickly let out by his handlers. I kept that autograph for years, but unfortunately, it, along with some other autographs and concert ticket stubs that I had collected through high school and college, were all thrown out as I purged my belongings in my move away from Davenport.
I was born. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too. Up there beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go down
Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my.
And that's Sam Cooke with his now classic, Change Gonna Come. I say now classic because, you know, that song was not nearly as popular at the time of release as it has become over the years. Now, getting back to my mom. Have you ever been shocked by something your parents said? My folks were pretty reserved and guarded against expressing their personal feelings. But sometimes you'd get a hint of what's behind that authority figure. I had been away from my hometown for 6 months or so. And in that time, I had learned a boogie-woogie tune on the piano. And while sitting now in my childhood home, I sat down at the family piano, which I always did when I returned home. It was a very grounding experience for me. I just played the same old songs from my very limited repertoire that I'd been playing for years. I'm really not a very good piano player. Then I played the boogie-woogie tune that I had learned. And my mom, she gets up from her seat and says, "Now, I like that music," and even started a little dance to it. "Wow, Mom, could it be? Are you a little frisky?" At that time, that was way too much information for me to dwell on. But she said how this was the music that she loved to dance to as a young woman. Well, I can handle it now. So here's to you, Mom. Here's Albert Ammons and his Rhythm Kings with the Boogie Woogie Stomp.
Thank you.
And that's the Boogie Woogie Stomp by Albert Ammons and his Rhythm Kings. Well, speaking of family, I have a special niece who recently celebrated her 30th birthday. Hannah Mae is the daughter of my brother Tom. There was a time in my life, well, 30 years ago, as a matter of fact, when I had professed how I didn't need family. There was turmoil from divorce and blah, blah, blah. I won't get into it. But my brother knew that I did need family, and he and his wife showed up at my house, and with them, their less than a year old baby girl. That was Hannah Mae. I realized right then, I did need family. Always have, always will. Thanks for being there for me, Hannah, even if it may have been lost on you at the time. This goes out to me and Hannah, one of our favorite songs of all time.
It's not time to make a change. Just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. How can I try to explain? When I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story. From the moment I could talk, I was ordered to listen. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go. Change, just sit down, take it slowly. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to go through. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old, but I'm happy. All the times that I've cried, keeping all the things I knew inside. It's hard, but it's harder to ignore it. If they were right, I'd agree. But it's them they know, not me. Now there's a way, and I know that I have to go away. I know I have to go.
Cat Stevens and Father and Son. This is another one for you, Hannah. We're here for you, too, whenever you need us.
So glad the world can't hear my thoughts. If the world could hear my thoughts, from this world I'd likely be shot like a cannonball. I leave the light on, yes I do. Climb up to where I love the view. Sometimes dark comes shining through like a cannonball. The cuckoo bird is not the best. Watch it rob the robin's nest. Watch it swallow the swallow's eggs. Such a sweet song. And I would never think to judge. There's nothing evil in a flood. Don't worry, I forgive you, bud. Such a sweet song. Everything there is a time. For every justice there's a crime. We might not see, we might not shine. Someone will. And when you fall down in a hole, you don't care who drops the rope. All you can do is holler and hope someone will.
And that's Nathan Moore with the title cut from his new album, Holler and Hope. And now let's get to my interview with Dr. Matt Davies. You hear me talk a lot about Saranac Lake, New York, and that is where I live now. But for 32 years, I lived in Stanton, Virginia. We have a house there and are just about ready to move back now that we're about to retire. We've had the house for a couple years now, and it's close to the historic downtown area, and we have really, really great neighbors. Well, Matt and his beautiful wife, Christina, they're our next-door neighbors. They keep an eye on our place and let workers in and out when we're not there. Fabulous people. Matt and I sat down recently to talk Shakespeare. Now, I admittedly am not an expert on Shakespeare, but with the arrival of the American Shakespeare Center, locating in Stanton back in 2001, I have become more interested in having another go at it. My aversion to Shakespeare stems back to feeling stupid that I couldn't understand the language straight away. And many I know have been put off in the same way. What a shame. So I spoke with this Shakespearean actor and scholar about this very problem. Matt is a Welshman by blood and was raised in London. He has his PhD in Renaissance drama from the University of Texas at Austin and now teaches acting and directing in the Shakespeare and Performance Graduate Program at Stanton's own Mary Baldwin University. Matt is quite accomplished. He earned 3 fellowships while in Austin and has earned many Critics Circle Awards associated with his directing and acting. The first part of my interview, unfortunately, with Matt was eaten by a bug in the recording machine, so we'll have to pick up as the recorder sorted itself out. Here's my interview with Dr. Matt Davies from my living room in Stanton, Virginia. Did you major in acting or in theater?
I did not. I majored in English all the way through. PhD was in English, PhD, master's English, mainly because in the UK we don't have we don't have a liberal arts education like you do here. You take a subject at 18, and that's what you study. Hmm. And to me, it was either English or history, and history just had too many dates. And it was the closest thing to a liberal arts education because, you know, it's literature, and it can be any form of literature you want to study, mm-hmm. right? And so a lot of it was to do with plays. I knew I wanted to be an actor, but I wasn't yet ready to go and train to be an actor. And I think at 18, you're too young.
And you have done professional acting. Where did that start?
After that, I was going to go to drama school, as we call it there, and then I got a job. So I started working at 23, and I was in the UK working till I was 36 or 7.
Working as an actor.
As an actor, yeah.
And then you decided to get your PhD.
I did. I was touring America doing Shakespeare, five-handed Shakespeare's with a company called, well, ten-handed Shakespeare's, to be precise, five actors, where we'd play all the parts. You'd do the whole show, and we can persuade you that, you know, by the end of it, when we took the bow, we'd go, well, where are all the other actors? Like, no, we played all the parts. So it's kind of tourable Shakespeare, and we were doing that. And it was started by Patrick Stewart and Ben Kingsley back in the day, actors from the London stage. RSC, Royal Shakespeare Company actors. And I was doing that for years, coming and going. And I kept going through Austin. And if you go through Austin too many times, you stay.
So you stayed there and you studied and you got your PhD. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And then how did you find your way to Stanton and Mary Baldwin?
Yeah, I got a job. I was going home. Now, and then I realized I didn't know where home was. And in fact, I got the job before I did the PhD. So I was a good 2.5 years out before finishing. I hadn't written a word of my dissertation. Which the people who hired me knew, but they said, don't tell anyone, just make sure you write it. So I came here and wrote the PhD next door.
I see. Right.
Yeah. Whilst I started teaching, they were looking here in our program. It's a peculiar program in it's Shakespeare and performance, by which we mean it's both the study and the practice of Shakespeare. So you study, you understand Shakespeare through knowing the texts, the context, and the performance of it. So they were looking for actors, theatre makers who had PhDs, and there aren't that many. It turns out, I didn't know this, that there aren't many of those around.
And when you said next door, you are actually my next door neighbor, which is great.
Yes, as we
sit here in my house in Stanton, Virginia. So this is great. And Matt is a very trusting fella. I at least I hope he is, because he has a key to my house.
And a door soon to your garden.
Right. That's right. So now, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on here was because of my interest in Shakespeare. And I have not had an interest in Shakespeare. Years and years ago, I, like many people, saw a Shakespeare play. And I remember watching The Merchant of Venice, and I walked out, and I didn't understand one conversation that was had. And unfortunately, just because of the language. And when I heard Joni Mitchell say, "You're in my blood like holy wine. You taste so bitter and yet so sweet. I could drink a case of you and still be on my feet. I'd still be on my feet." And that was poetry to me. And that told me all I needed to know about the human condition was in rock and roll. And so that's where I've gotten my culture. Now that we have the Shakespeare Theater here in town, and you know, I would like to revisit this. So I, like many people, would like to find out what is the road that a person needs to take to be able to understand Shakespeare, because it certainly is a study. So what about the language? Is that how people spoke at that time?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes and no, I think. It is a different language, and it is easy when you've been doing a lot of Shakespeare, which I have all my professional life, but I felt very much like you. I really couldn't be doing with Shakespeare at all until I was about 26. I became a professional actor at 22. My first four jobs, theatre jobs, were all Shakespeare, and I was furious because all I wanted to do was modern political dramas that were going to change the world, like any young actor, right? And I wasn't interested in all this Shakespeare stuff. And therefore, surprise, surprise, wasn't very good at it. And then I happened to do Macbeth, one of his big hitters, you know, and it changed my life. And suddenly it was like, oh, a light went on.
And what was it about Macbeth?
Well, it was it is a wonderful play. It's a very clear play. I mean, the poetry is sublime, but it's not a complicated play to follow. So, you know, it's not philosophical. And I would hasten to add, Shakespeare is not a philosopher, he's a playwright. He poses questions, he never answers them. That's your job. That's your business. That's the audience's business. It's not his. That's what makes him so clever and long-lasting, right? He doesn't never goes out of date, because he's never in date, right? And I had to do it very quickly. I was taking over from somebody, and I had about 2.5 weeks to prepare. And it's a very big part, and I was a young actor to do it. And I had to, instead of preparing in the way that actors prepare for roles, I just did it and found, and I trusted the language. And I found the language started to look after me because I wasn't fighting it. I wasn't trying to make it modern. I wasn't trying to make sense of it. I just started to trust it. And then people said they could understand what I was talking about. So in many ways, one of the answers I'd say, you know, I was thinking about this when you said, I want to talk about this. Of how do you get into Shakespeare? You know, the first thing is, and this is can be tricky, it is to see some good Shakespeare. A good Shakespearean should sound completely modern. They should not sound, when we train, I train actors to do Shakespeare. I said, my job is actually to make you sound like you're not doing Shakespeare. Because that a good professional Shakespearean doesn't. And you know, the audience will come out and go, so you modernized it. You updated it. I'm so relieved you did. And we go, we didn't change a word. We just were understandable to you. And I say to young actors, 90% of an actor, Shakespeare actor's job is to be understood. And then the audience will think you're the best actor in the world. Mm-hmm. Because they don't feel stupid. Mm-hmm. Right? So you know, there are going to be words that are weird. There are constructions that are strange.
That was the problem that I had, was the construction, the verbs coming at the end. You right. know, they're kind of setting up, and all of a sudden there's this action at the end. And I'm going, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, okay. I'm lost.
Yeah,
yeah. A very famous teacher said, you know, the danger, a director. And he goes, the danger with Shakespeare is he will go on without you. You know, and suddenly you're two scenes in and you're going, I'm lost. Right. And if you can't understand it, what you'll do is you'll look at that really nice dress, that nice costume piece, that very attractive actor, and you will not be listening to the story, right. And you're lost.
Yeah.
So our job is to make sure that you are never, ever lost, mm-hmm. right?
And I know, okay, so we have one suggestion, that is Macbeth would be a good play and a good Macbeth to watch.
Yeah, well, and you can watch one of the things I did was watch, I think, 5 or 6 film versions of Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
And some very variable, bizarre versions. Orson Welles' version of Macbeth is extraordinarily weird, but it was terrific. And so you can go live. We'd always say go live, if possible. In the time of COVID, this is very tricky. But there are excellent Shakespeare films.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. I mean, he is the most prolific screenwriter in Hollywood history.
And never won an Oscar.
Never won an Oscar himself. He's outraged.
Right. Well, I know that the iambic pentameter, the rhythm of the language, has been something I've been extremely interested in as I've been studying up. And then looking at, well, let's take Joni Mitchell's song that I just quoted. I could drink a case of you and still be on my feet, still be on my feet. And so that it's not the pentameter, but it is an iambic rhythm, and the rhythm of a soft syllable and then a more emphasized syllable and a soft syllable and more. Yep. Almost like a dance. And even though you don't, it's very subtle, it is an iambic pentameter of a form that Shakespeare used. Could you explain that, and how important was it for someone to understand that and to realize that they're almost listening to music as they hear Shakespeare? Is that a good offering?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. So when I was a young actor, getting all these Shakespeare roles I didn't want,
mm-hmm.
And resisting the language, I just wanted to paraphrase everything. So the trusting of the language, part of it became trusting the form. Sir Peter Hall, who founded the Royal Shakespeare Company back in the 1960s, he had a famous quote that he said, first comes the form, then comes the feeling. In modern acting, you feel something, then you speak. In Shakespeare, you speak and you feel through the process of speaking. So it's an inverted version, right? So you have to understand the form. So now, but that said, it doesn't mean, therefore, that an audience member goes, now I'm going to be listening to iambic pentameter today, you know, and I want to be able to hear it. But what they will do, everybody has a heartbeat. So our job as actors is to get the heartbeats in rhythm. Right. So once we can control the audience, mm-hmm. to, you know, we can make your heart go faster. Mm-hmm. We can make it go slower, mm-hmm. depending on these heartbeats.
And the heartbeat being two beats. Ba-boom.
Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom.
Right.
Right. So pentameter or tetrameter. Most music is tetrameter, 4-beat, 4-4. Right.
Yeah.
This is 5. So it makes it quite tricky. But I think the crucial thing is to feel the heartbeat of it. What Shakespeare made famous was blank verse. Blank verse is not rhymed verse, mm-hmm. right? So there are three forms that Shakespeare writes in. He writes in rhyming verse. You know you're listening to poetry because it's rhymed, right? And we don't speak in rhymes, mm-hmm. you know? So if you do A Midsummer Night's Dream, one of the famous plays that people come across a lot, lots and lots of comedy of errors you mentioned, it's virtually all rhyming couplets, mm-hmm. right? That's not what Shakespeare normally writes in. He normally writes in blank verse. To be or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And on, right, these don't rhyme. So we call that blank. And then there is prose. And a third of Shakespeare's writing is in prose. And people will go, oh, well, that's what the common folk speak. Well, Hamlet speaks a lot of prose, and he's a prince. So it's very complicated. So our job is to say, when are we very heightened? When we're in rhyme? When we're in blank verse, and when we're in prose, which is the most prosaic form of speaking, mm-hmm. very muscular form of speaking, the blank verse is, frankly, I don't think we're meant to hear it. I think it gives actors information, but essentially it's meant to sound natural. Mm-hmm. It's meant to capture thought going into words. The instantaneous moment of thoughts becoming words. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, an audience needs to understand the form so much. A very good friend of mine, Ian Ballamy, who is a big jazz musician and composer in the UK, one of my best friends, he came to see A Midsummer Night's Dream that I did when I was in London. I took it back to London, and he came out and he was a bit like you in the sense he's like, Shakespeare, I never really got it, right? Great musician, right? And he came out and his eyes were alive because he said, it was crazy, Matt. There were times when it was 4-4, there was trimeter, and he goes, and then it went into this 5-beat stuff going on, you know, and he said, it's mad, it's wild, I want to write some music for it.
Wow.
And he did.
And so during throughout a particular play, you're going to experience all three forms of that writing?
Yeah, you will. I mean, you know, there'll be plays that are virtually all rhyme, very few. Plays that are virtual blank verse, a lot. But mostly it's a balance of prose and blank verse with a few rhyming bits here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So besides Macbeth, what would be another play that you would recommend being one of the earlier plays to study?
Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, Romeo and Juliet is a great play.
Mm-hmm.
People like to say they don't like Romeo and Juliet because they've seen it so often or it's too well known. Because it's a wonderful play,
mm-hmm.
and it speaks to young people amazingly, right? But the older characters are fabulous as well. I mean, you know, and it's about parental conflict with youth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what it's about, mm-hmm. you know. So I think that's a very, very good play to see. And then so that's like a comedy to a tragedy of Macbeth.
And Romeo and Juliet was a tragedy.
Yeah. Well, it's very clever, though, because it starts as a comedy. And then it flips at the death, mm-hmm. at a big death in the middle, and it suddenly everything changes, and it becomes a tragedy. So that was fairly radical when he did it. I think there are some wonderful histories. I mean, he started as an historian and historical playwright.
Right. And he wrote about kings, King Henry.
And he wrote about kings. Henry IV, Part One is my favorite history. It's all about kings, but it's also got this character called Falstaff, who is one of the great comic creations, this outrageous and drunken old knight who hangs out with the young prince and gets him to all sorts of trouble. There are Welsh and Scottish and Irish and Northerners and Southerners. And, you know, he's trying to get the whole panoply of England.
All right. So we have histories, we have comedies, and we have tragedies. And Macbeth, a tragedy,
yeah.
of Romeo and Juliet, a comedy that turned into a tragedy. And what else would you recommend?
Well, there was a late form, which he never used this term, but it's become known as the romance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his final phase. The point of a tragedy is it's going to end tragically, and it's good for us because it kind of wrecks us. And then at the end of it, we feel better. In the romances, they seem ridiculous because outside forces suddenly come to solve everything. But for him, that's called forgiveness. So these, and the play that I would say epitomizes that as the great romance is The Winter's Tale, which is, again, a play I had no interest in at all when I was a young man. And strangely, I'm liking it more and more.
Right.
Which, you know.
Would you suggest then seeing a play and then maybe reading about it and then going back and seeing it again? Or do you think you should go from one play to another, to another, to another?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. Well, you know, these plays afford re-seeing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, Shakespeare would no longer really be with us, right? And the worst, the most dangerous thing is when at school, at high school probably, right, at junior high or something, you get to read Julius Caesar, a perfectly good play, but it is very masculine and very rhetorical. And you read it out around the class and it's as boring as anything, right? And that's the end of Shakespeare for you. You need to be able to read Shakespeare. So my suggestion would be I would see a play. If it's a well-known play, just find out if you can find on Amazon Prime a version of it. Mm-hmm. So until the last 10 years, there were many film versions that were adaptations. Now, with the improvement of multicam, you can now see productions of stage plays as well that don't feel like they're miles away, mm-hmm. and that you're not in the room. They really put you in the room, mm-hmm. right? So I would definitely watch a couple of other versions to see that there isn't one way to do this. There is no one way to do this play. There is certainly no right way to do a Shakespeare play. And then, you know, in the ideal world, you'd be a part of a reading club and you'd read them. Mm-hmm. Or you'd read them with your partner, you know, and go, can we just read them and just hear it out loud?
One of the reasons we go see plays, one of the reasons why we read literature, is to learn not only about the world, but ultimately about ourselves. And when you see, my goodness, that's me they're talking about, and oh, that's how he solved it, or just to help ourselves to be able to understand life as we're trying to live it. So did Shakespeare, was he able to reveal the human condition as well or better than anybody? Would that be one of the reasons why he has lasted so long?
I'm sure that's true. Not being a philosopher myself, I feel uncomfortable about being an expert on this. But the trick about him was that he didn't reveal the human condition in a very obvious way, or by saying, let's have these two people bare their souls. Mm-hmm. So in modern plays, tend to be much smaller. They tend to have, you know, a few people around, we call it kitchen sink drama, right? Regaling the world with the misery of their lives, right? Shakespeare's plays are huge. So when you direct a Shakespeare play, you know, even the simple ones, you go, it never stops. Hmm. There are always people doing, there's always a dance, there's always a fight, there's always a huge scene here, there's always a witty scene here. You know, it never ends. It's a panoply of human life. And that's I think that's why he remains a great playwright, mm-hmm. because and why he's quite hard to do, and why you need to train to do Shakespeare, is because you've just got to embrace the magnitude of Shakespeare. It's not small. Nothing about him is small. Mm-hmm. Nothing about watching it is small. So it means if you feel left out, you feel really miserable, right? If you get included, it becomes this extraordinary experience. Some people here might have heard of the Globe Theatre in London. Mm-hmm. You know, it was rebuilt by a Canadian, right? So, you know, it took a North American to actually do it. Been talked about for decades and never happened. And everyone said it was going to be museum theatre. And I lived just down the road from there. I didn't go for 5 years because I said it looked like a theme pub to me with its thatched roof, right? And it wasn't. It sort of changed things very radically because they said the audience are back in the game. Mm. When they're not just, not just sitting there, half the time they're standing, mm-hmm. right? But they are part of the show, much like a really, really good concert, you know, where you go, this concert is not going to happen without the audience. It's just...
But I do remember going to see a Bruce Springsteen concert in the 80s and when he would turn the lights on, and it all started with Tramps Like Us, you know, Baby, We Were Born to Run. And when that song came on and when that line came, Tramps Like Us, all of a sudden the lights went on and you could see everybody. And it was the most inclusive. Mm. It was just interested in. I got chills right now thinking about it. It was a moment where we were all in this together. It wasn't me alone sitting up there watching this band and just sitting back and enjoying the experience, which is fine too. But this was a moment where everybody felt, oh my God, we are all a part of this together. It was beautiful. Yeah. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. So, satire. So he definitely hated hypocrisy. Mm. So did he reveal the hypocrisy in his characters through satire, or through or just allow them to be so hypocritical that the audience realized, oh my God, you're full of crap?
You know, you had to be very careful. They could close down the theaters quite easily. There's a lot of subtlety in the way he would express his satire. So again, the trick with Shakespeare is, how does he write about — a lot of his histories were very much, you wrote history to talk about the present time, because you weren't allowed to talk about the present time. That was considered too dangerous. In fact, it was illegal. So you weren't officially allowed to stage a living person. So you hid them in other characters, right? Or you hid them in other historical periods. And Shakespeare wrote about the Wars of the Roses, the first period of, as it were, revolution in England between aristocracies. Or he wrote about the Romans and the Greeks, mm-hmm. right? And that was the kind of the two historical periods that you used to talk about this current day. And then, of course, that current day is not our current day. So then you're like, well, does it matter to us? So I think the trick then is you have to find a way to make those histories also be talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, and history does repeat itself, and so it's probably not that difficult to be able to to compare. Yeah.
Yep, it's — history is both progressive and cyclical, right? It keeps going forward whilst going back on itself. It's right. This kind of complicated —
unfortunately —
double. Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah. And they recognize that completely mm-hmm. at the time. That's what Renaissance was all about, right? Rebirth, a recycle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the English Renaissance, you know. So,
and what about the relationship with the church? What was his relationship with the church?
Oh, you know, that's opening a can of worms. He was street smart. So as far as we're aware, he never got into trouble with the authorities or the church in the way other playwrights did. There are plays that we think didn't happen. There's a play called Troilus and Cressida, a very hard play, and it's definitely about current political events. And mm-hmm. it was almost certainly never performed at the time, and I suspect because it was like, it ain't happening. You know, I think he just knew how to play the game.
Mm-hmm. This wasn't a question that I had planned to ask you, and so forgive me if I throw you off on this, but let's take the play Hamilton and compare it to a Shakespearean play. There certainly was history in that. There certainly is entertainment in that. There was certainly comedy in that. There was certainly tragedy in that. Would you say that Hamilton lived up to a Shakespearean writing?
Absolutely. I think Shakespeare would have been blown away by Hamilton.
Right.
And one of the things we teach in our program is rhetoric. It's not something that's taught a lot, you know, the structuring of language and argument, because the argument being that most of the actors and the theatre makers at that time went through a grammar school education where they were taught from the same rhetoric book, which means — and there were no directors in those days — which meant that, you know, actors would have the play given to them and they would have to understand what the playwright meant. But without anybody helping to explain it, the rehearsals were very, very brief. And you did it because rhetorically you could understand each other, right? And Hamilton is an incredibly, rhetorically, very, very sophisticated piece. And an old colleague of mine wrote about this on a blog. She's a writer now and down in North Carolina. But she wrote this blog about Shakespeare's rhetoric and Hamilton. And Lin-Manuel Miranda got heard of it and was like, I'm clever. Me and Shakespeare, who knew? And they had started a conversation and she was going, no, Shakespeare would have been blown away with what you were doing with your language, mm-hmm. because it was both invigorating and enormously entertaining, and just reminded us all that, you know, language is pleasurable. Playing with language is pleasurable. Mm-hmm. It's not utilitarian. We don't just use it to impart information. That's mm-hmm. not all it does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does so much more than that. Yeah, I think he'd have loved Hamilton.
That's great to hear. And now, we speak in an iambic rhythm.
We do.
I've learned, and it's obvious once you learn about iambic rhythm. Are there plays now being written in this iambic pentameter, like the poetic writings of Shakespeare?
It does happen. I would say that, I mean, the important thing about the iambic pentameter, at least most of us believe, I believe, is that you set up the rhythm so that sometimes you can break it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So, for emphasis. it's the breaking of it which carries significance.
Right.
Right.
Like you're setting up something really important.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you know, and so you create heart murmurs. Mm. You got the beat, and then you create a murmur, and the murmurs make you feel nervous or whatever, you know. Well, let's put it this way. Shakespeare developed the iambic pentameter, the blank verse, so far, played around with it so jazzily that, you'd say one of the actors here in this scene has to be the drummer. Hmm. And keep the beat going, because he's going all over the place now. And he knows he can do it because he knows his actors very well. They had the same company for years, right? So he was writing for his actors. Mm-hmm. He was writing for his musicians. Mm-hmm. So he got more and more complicated, more and more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Once he died, about 15 years after he died, 20 years after he died, the theatres were shut. The Puritans finally got their way and shut the theatres. They opened again 12 years later. And nobody wrote in blank verse anymore.
I see.
They were writing in prose. Mm-hmm. And it was like Shakespeare took it so far that he almost dismantled it. Hmm.
So is there anything else that you think, anything that we may have missed?
Some people swear by occasionally reading some of the sonnets. Many people consider his poetry incredible. So some people definitely say, pick up a couple of sonnets and have a read of those. You know, the sonnet is a very tight form. It's a 14-line, very strict metrical form. And the idea there is you're meant to capture something of the human condition in this tiny little form. And it's the compression of it that creates the art, right? That frees the art. I find them a little too tight for me. I like something a little more kind of free-flowing.
Not enough fights.
Not enough kissing, you know.
Very good. And so what about you personally now? Will you be doing more acting in the future, or has teaching just pretty much engulfed your schedule?
No. I mean, the reason I took this job, I was interested in this job, was because, they encourage you to remain, you need to carry on doing your theatre. The students won't take you very seriously if you don't, mm-hmm. honestly. So I work all over this region, and in fact, you know, I just did the American Shakespeare Center over the summer, which was tricky because of COVID, and that might come again. I've directed there as well, so you know, I will continue to work. If the minute I stop working, the minute is I stop teaching.
Well, Matt Davies, thank you so much for coming on From the Hip Radio. I learned a tremendous amount, and I know that you've stimulated the interest in our listeners.
Well, yeah. Thank you very much. Go and enjoy some Shakespeare. Just find some good Shakespeare.
Will do. Luckily, we have it right here in town.
We do.
A love-struck Romeo, sing the streets a serenade, laying everybody low with a love song that he made. Find the streetlight, steps out of the shade, says something like, "You and me, babe, how about it?" Juliet says, "Hey, it's Romeo. He nearly gave me a heart attack. He's underneath the window." She's singing, "Eli, my boyfriend's back. You shouldn't come around here singing up at people like that. What you gonna do about it?" Juliet, the dice was loaded from the start, and I bet many you exploded into my heart. And I forget the movie song. When you gonna realize it was just that the time was wrong? Juliet, different streets, they both were streets of shame, both dirty, both mean. Yes, and the dream was just the same. And I dreamed your dream for you, and now your dream is real. How can you look at me as if I was just another one of your deals, when you can fall for chains of steel?
You can fall for chains of gold. You can fall for pretty strangers and the promises they hold. You promised me everything. You promised me thick and thin, yeah. Now you just say, oh, Romeo, yeah. You know, I used to have a scene with him. Juliet, when we made love, you used to cry. You said, I love you like the stars above. Talks like the talk on the TV, and I can't do a love song like the way it's meant to be. I can't do everything, but I'll do anything for you. I can't do anything except be in love with you. And all I do is miss you and the way we used to be. All I do is keep the beat. Bad company, and all I do is kiss you through the bars of a rhyme. Julie, I do the stars with you anytime. Now, Julie, when we made love, you used to cry. I said, I love you like the stars above. I love you till I die. A serenade, laying everybody low with a love song that he made. Find a convenient street light, steps out of the shade, and says something like, you and me, babe.
That was Dire Straits with Romeo and Juliet. Back in 1979, after having graduated from chiropractic college, I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina to take an associate position in a chiropractic office there. I knew that I wanted to leave Iowa, and I was drawn to the mountains and the ocean. North Carolina had both. Ironically, however, Charlotte had neither, as it is situated in the Piedmont area between the Smoky Mountains and the Atlantic Ocean. Now, I say that I wanted to leave Iowa, and I did, but that's not to disparage Iowa. I have great memories of Davenport, and now that I'm nearly retired, I'm looking forward to spending more time out there. Anyway, while in Charlotte, I got to see many bands, including the Grateful Dead and the Dixie Dregs that summer of 1979. And in the fall, Dire Straits, with their lead singer, lead guitar player, and principal songwriter, Mark Knopfler, they came to play. It was a weekday, though, and once again, I had to work early the next morning, so I had to make a decision. Making Movies, their second album, hadn't come out yet, and at that time, I had only been exposed to their breakthrough hit, The Sultans of Swing. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's a good song, but that Stratocaster guitar sound is so distinctive. I wondered if all their songs would be nothing but a verse then guitar lick, then another verse, then the same guitar lick. So I made a prediction, made a judgment. I felt that these guys were going to be nothing but one-hit wonders and fade like so many others. Well, I think it's safe to say I was wrong, utterly wrong. I'm almost ashamed of myself for making that judgment, not because I missed that one concert, but I prided myself in having good musical taste and felt that I could separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. Well, it is humbling. Mark Knopfler would go on to become a legend, with Chet Atkins himself bestowing the coveted and sparingly given CGP degree upon him. That's Certified Guitar Player. Here's a song by Mark Knopfler, a duet with someone whose voice you will certainly recognize. It's the title cut from his second solo album, Sailing to Philadelphia.
I am Jeremiah Dixon, I am a Geordie boy. Glass of wine with you, sir, and the ladies I'm enjoying. Old Durham and Northumberland is measured up by my own hand. It was my fate from birth to make my mark upon the earth.
He calls me Charlie Mason, stargazer am I. It seems that I was born to chart the evening sky. They'd cut me out for baking bread, but I had other dreams instead. This baker's boy from the West Country would join the Royal Society. We are sailing to Philadelphia, a world away from the coaly tide. Sailing to Philadelphia to draw the line, the Mason-Dixon line. Surveyor Dixon, but I swear you'll make me mad. The West will kill us both, you gullible Geordie lad. You talk of liberty, how can America be free? A Geordie and a baker's boy in the forests of the Iroquois.
Now hold your head up, Mason, see America lies there. The morning tide has raised the capes of Delaware. Come up and feel the sun, a new morning has begun. Another day will make it clear why your star should guide us here. We are sailing to Philadelphia, a world away from the coaly tide. Sailing to Philadelphia to draw the line, the Mason-Dixon line.
That's Mark Knopfler and James Taylor with Sailing to Philadelphia. Now, you've heard me talk of my many trips to Ireland. People comment often saying, wow, you must get to hear lots of traditional Irish music while you're over there. And yes, it's true. There is traditional music everywhere you go. But the Irish, they're quite musically literate themselves. And when my band played in Westport, County Mayo in 1998, a bunch of local musicians showed up to play with us. One of them was a fellow by the name of Derek McGowan on guitar. And we all just fell in love with him and his wife Eve and their two daughters, Lisa and Kate. Derek even played on our album. He fit in so well because, well, he diverted from the traditional music sound and lent a very familiar sound to our playing. This will give you an idea of where Derek's head is at musically and the cast of characters that I gravitated toward on my many trips back to Westport. This is a live recording of his band, the Piston Slappers, with the American hit, 6 Days on the Road.
Checking on down the line. I'm a little overweight. My little girl will be high. Nothing bothers me tonight. Our daughter's scared, all right. 6 days in the road, I'm gonna see my baby tonight. I got 10 brother keys and a sweet boat to overdrive. I take a little rock pill, my eyes are open wide. I just passed Demon Heights. I've been passing everything inside. 6 days in the road, see my baby tonight. Come on. That don't mean she's slow. It's a good thing blowing from my smokestack. It's just like a stove. My hometown coming in sight. You think I'm happy, baby, baby, you're right. 6 days in the road, gonna see my baby tonight. 6 days in the road, I'm gonna see my baby tonight.
Those are the Piston Slappers from Westport, County Mayo, Ireland, with Paul Kerwin on keyboards, Derek McGowan on guitar. And not only have I gone to Ireland to visit these folks,
but I hired the Piston Slappers 2 years in a row. They came to the States and were a part of the lineup for the Fortune Williams Music Festival I ran in the early 2000s. They were a hit for sure. And that'll be about it for episode 6 of From the Hip Radio. And before we finish the show with another song from Freda, I want to remind you that you can contact me at fromthehipradio@gmail.com if you'd like to comment or make any suggestions. Now, from her live album, Live at Cabell Hall, we conclude this week with Freda Epstein and Time Alone.
Oh, the grace of true love holds. Hearts grow weary for time alone. You give it room and the warmth to hold. It'll always come home. And true love is faithful all on its own. Hearts know when they should fly alone. When the mind is rested and the heart's at ease, true love can give to each other's needs. All the grace of true love holds. Hearts grow weary for time alone. You give it room and the warmth to hold. It'll always come home. One of these days you'll need the harbor in me. All the grace of true love holds. Hearts grow weary for time alone. You give it room and the warmth to hold. It'll always come home. All the grace of true love holds. Hearts grow weary for time alone. You give it room and the warmth to hold. It'll always come home.